with smooth boundary. And I'm looking at the inverse from the Schrödinger equation on this manifold M. So V is some potential, so it's an L infinity function on M. And here looking at the boundary measurements or the Dirichlet to Neumann map for the Schrödinger equation in M. So this is the map which takes the Dirichlet F into the normal derivative, the Riemannian normal derivative of the solution of the following Dirichlet problem. Okay, so basically you have your the manifold here, Mg, and then basically you have the unknown potential V, so it's just a function in M, and then you want to determine some properties of V, and would hope to determine the whole potential from some measurements on the boundary. Okay, so the basic question is, so if V1 and V2 are in L infinity of M, and these two potentials give you the same measurements at the boundary, we want to show that V1 is equal to V2. Okay. And so I argued yesterday that the positive answer to this question would imply a solution of the anisotropic Calderon problem for matrix in a fixed conformal class. Okay, so what I did in the very end of yesterday's lecture, I basically gave you the main approach for trying to do this. So if the boundary measurements for two potentials are the same, so I showed and at least stated that in this case, just by doing the integration by parts using Green's formula, you will see that the integral of the difference of the potential against the product of any two solutions will vanish. So this was just integration by parts. And okay, so this reduces the question to the following thing. So if you could, so you would like to show that the set of products of solutions of the Schrödinger equation is dense. Let's say in L1 of M. And this would imply a positive answer to the question. Okay. So, and this is really the approach we are going to take. So somehow, it sounds like a simple question. I mean, you just show that the products of solutions to some PDEs are dense. But it turns out to be maybe surprisingly difficult. At least there's no really easy ways of doing this. And so Alberto Calderon in the paper, where he basically introduced this problem, he tried to prove this for for a related equation, for the conductivity equation in Rn, and he wasn't able to do it. But he introduced an idea which has been very influential in this whole business. So let me go ahead and somehow explain how this fact is proved when M is just a domain in Rn with the Euclidean metric. Sure. So M is now just the closure of a bounded domain in Rn with smooth boundary. Okay, so then your Schrödinger equation is just the Euclidean Laplacian plus V. And so you first try to look at the situation where there's no potential and try to find some harmonic functions which you could use to show that the products are dense. And so what Calderon did was he used this, so use the harmonic functions. Which are, so he does complex exponentials. It's e to the rho dot x, where rho is a vector in Cn. And you see that this thing is harmonic. So you take the Laplacian of u naught. And this is equal to, we basically just get the rows down, so you get the inner product. So this is just a complex dot product, so there's no conjugate. So this is equal to zero if and only if this complex vector rho is chosen so that it's, you know, the dot product with itself is zero. And you can easily find such vectors. So somehow you would like to use these harmonic functions to produce some solutions of the Schrödinger equation so that you could show that their products are dense. And the next step would be this basic result of Sylvester and Ullmann. And this 1987 showed that that somehow you can take these special harmonic functions and convert them into the exact solutions of the Schrödinger equation by adding some correction terms. So if Vj are now L infinity functions in the bounded domain of the following form. So I need to show that the products are dense, so I'm going to take two. So first you have the complex exponential, and then you have some corrections to make it then a solution of the Schrödinger equation with a non-zero potential. So I write the first one like this, and the second one, eventually I need to take products, so somehow, okay, so let's do this first. So A1 here is some amplitude, it could be just the constant 1, or it could be something else as well. But the point is somehow that when this complex vector is very large, then you can find these correction terms R, so that they are going to be very small. So actually, R1 is going to 0 when the complex vector goes to infinity. So somehow, if this vector is very large, then this error term here is negligible, and you're almost left with the original complex exponential. Okay, so but if rho is very large, and you need to take the product of u1 and u2, so you don't want any exponential growth in your product, so you take the other one so that the exponentials will cancel. And also here r2 goes to 0 as rho goes to infinity. Okay, So if this complex vector is very large, then basically these correction terms go away. So and then it turns out that you can choose A1 to be e to the I x dot xi, where xi is a fixed vector in Rn, and choose A2 is equal to 1. And if you make these choices, so then your U1, U2, the product, will look like just e to the ix dot xi when the complex vector is very large. And these things obviously are dense, because if you integrate against all of these and you get zero, so then the Fourier transform of the function is zero, and then the function itself will be zero. Yes, so there's stuff which I'm omitting here. So you need to choose the row here dependent on the xi. And this thing only works when you have enough dimensions, so that for a fixed xi you can find suitable rows that you can carry out this whole thing. So you need enough directions. Okay, so that's kind of Euclidean picture. And but now we are working on Riemannian manifold, so what should we do here? Well, you could try to find some kind of analogs of these complex exponentials. And some of the problem is then when you are on a Riemannian manifold, for instance, if you want to write down this phase function, it's a linear function. Of course, you can always write down linear functions in local coordinates, but on a general manifold, there's no somehow global analog of a linear function, so it's not clear what you should do. But let's try to see how we could make this to work. So on the Riemannian manifold MG, so I'm going to, in this business, I'm going to forget the potentials to give you the idea of how things go. And so I'm going to try to find some approximate solutions somehow of a similar type. So I'm going to write U naught as E2, and then I'm going to have some phase function, and then I'm going to have some kind of amplitude multiplying this exponential. And I want these to be approximately harmonic, in a sense, which I'm going to make more precise in a moment. Okay, so here I'm going to take phi to be a real valued phase function. So in here the phase function was complex, but here I'm assuming that the complex part is embedded in this amplitude here. And so h is going to be a small parameter. So h pretty much looks like 1 over the norm of rho in what I just discussed. But I'm writing this way because it's consistent with the semi-classical conventions, which I'm going to use. And M is just some complex. You could call it amplitude. Okay. So assuming that we can in some way find approximate solutions of this type, and then we want to have some kind of procedure for converting these approximate solutions into exact solutions, because eventually you are going to need exact solutions of some PDE. Like, in the same way as here, we converted the approximate solution, the complex exponential, into exact solutions by adding some correction terms. So let's try the same thing. So one, two. To convert this into exact solutions. U is equal e to the minus phi over h. Let's do a similar thing. And now, in the same way, I would like my correction to be very small in the asymptotic limit when h goes to zero. So that this somehow this correction term, which I don't really know what it exactly looks like, would go away, and I would just be able to work with these things, which should be more explicit. Okay, so when can you do this? Okay, let me just write down a more precise thing, which would be enough. Bounded by constant times h, so it really goes to zero. Okay, so this u is going to be a harmonic function if and only if. Okay, so Laplacian of g e to the minus phi over h m plus r is equal to zero. Somehow in this business you assume that these approximate solutions are somehow explicit. You are expected to know them, and then this correction term is somehow the unknown thing which you need to cook up in order to get an exact solution. So I'm going to make this a little bit more symmetric. I'm going to multiply by the inverse of this exponential here, and I'm going to write this as an equation for r, so I'm going to leave r on the other side, and I'm going to put this known thing on the other side, so this will be okay. So this kind of shows that if we can solve an inhomogeneous equation for r where we have this kind of operator hitting r and we have some known right hand side, and if we can make sure that the solutions will satisfy a norm estimate, then we would be good. Okay, so let me give a name to this operator. I'm going to stick with the semi-classical conventions and make the right scalings of the parameters, and I'm calling this operator p phi of r, and I should also multiply this by h squared, and let's call this, for instance, h squared of f. Okay, so we reduce this thing into the task of finding functions phi so that the corresponding operator p phi is a conjugated Laplacian, is conjugated by exponentials, is such an operator that you can always solve equations of this type, and then you have a norm estimate for r. So it's kind of so this first part of this talk is unfortunately somewhat technical, so I want to get to somehow a definition which shows you what kind of phase functions would be good for this construction. So what kind of phase functions phi on a Riemannian manifold would allow you to somehow do a construction of this type, and would allow you to get close to proving that the products of solutions are dense. Okay, so I'm going to need phi such that this equation p phi r equals f is solvable in M with estimate r in L2 is bounded by a constant. Okay, so let me call this f tilde, which is h squared of f. So I need the L2 norm of R to be bounded by constant times h times the L2 norm of f. But if f tilde is h squared of f, so then actually you replace this by f tilde and h goes here. Okay, so somehow the final fact in this direction, so a necessary condition for this. Let's say you choose some R which is a smooth compact supported function in M, and then you just plug it in here. So then you will have right hand side in L2 and all that. So basically F tilde will be P phi of R. So you need to have this inequality, H times R in L2 of M is bounded by a constant times P phi R in L2 of M for all R in C infinity compactors for it in M. Okay, so this is an analytic condition which the phase function phi needs to satisfy. So P phi has to be an operator for which you have an inequality of this type. And so this is a Karlemann estimate. So Karlemann estimate means it's an L, in this case it's an L2 norm estimate for some operator P, which in our case is just the Laplacian conjugated by exponential weight. And there's a small parameter, so the idea is that there has to be some dependence in this estimate on the parameter, and you want this estimate, let's say, for all small h, smaller than some fixed h naught. So if you have some control on the powers of h in this estimate, then this will tell you that your correction terms will vanish in the asymptotic limit. Okay, so Karlemann estimates are, so they come up in a number of places in analysis. They are very useful in unique continuation of solutions of PDEs. They also come up in control theory, and nowadays they are used a lot in inverse problems. Okay, so there's one further thing. So eventually you want a solution U1 is equal to E minus phi over H M1 plus R1. But when you take the product, somehow in the same way you want to kill the exponential growth, because that's the only way how you can take the limit and make these correction terms go away. So you want U to be of the opposite, M2 plus R2, like this. So you have to be able to run the same argument for phi replaced by minus phi. So now we have actually arrived at the most important definition of today. So say that phi is a limiting Karlemann weight. I abbreviate LCW if the Karlemann estimate holds for phi and minus phi. I guess you won't be able to see this. Okay. So we are basically starting from this idea of how things are done in the Euclidean space, we have come up with a condition on phase functions on a Riemannian manifold, which would be a good starting point for trying to do the same thing. So then the question is, so when can you find functions like this? So as we see in the Euclidean case, if the metric is Euclidean, then the linear function satisfies these properties. So the linear function is limiting Karlemann weight in Rn. But if your manifold is not Euclidean, can you find such a function? And so today I'm going to give you or explain to you the result, which is I guess it's the first main theorem in this paper. With Dos Santos and Koenig and Ullmann. Which I'm mostly following here is that it's saying that the simply connected open Riemannian manifold admits a phase function of this type, which has all these nice properties, which might allow you to try to solve the inner form if and only if some conformal multiple of the metric G admits a parallel unit vector field. Okay, so there's a number of things which I need to explain here, but somehow this theorem gives you is it gives you a geometric interpretation of this somehow very technical analytic condition which we just derived. So okay, so what should I explain here? So I'm looking at here at open Riemannian manifolds. So these are manifolds with no boundary and no component is compact. For instance, an open set in Rn is an open manifold. And the reason is somehow this fact of having boundaries is not natural for the definition of limiting Calderon waves. So I just get rid of the boundary. And the idea is if you have an open manifold which has a limiting Calderon weight, then if you take any compact subregion of it, so then there will be Kalman estimates of this type in that compact subregion. So what is parallel? So the vector field is parallel if its covariant derivative vanishes everywhere. So what does this mean? So in particular, it means that the parallel transport of this vector along any closed curve will be the identity. So it keeps this vector fixed. So there's a theorem in Riemannian geometry called the Deram decomposition theorem for Riemannian manifold, which is saying that whenever you have a parallel vector field, which means which gives some restriction on the holonomy group of the manifold at the point, then you always know that the manifold has to split as a product. So intuitively what this condition means, let me give a local consequence of this result. So if Mg admits a limiting Calderon weight, so then there exists a system of local coordinates near any point so that you can write your metric in the following form. So there will be a conformal factor. So here we can have any conformal multiple. But then the matrix of the Riemannian metric in these coordinates will somehow split. So there will be one here, zero here, zero here, and then a metric depending only on the x prime variables. So this somehow means that up to this conformal multiple there exists the Euclidean direction in your manifold. So really what this means is that locally your manifold is embedded in a cylinder. So there's a direction x1 which is somehow looks very Euclidean because you have just the Euclidean metric here. And then you have some transverse part which could be any n minus one dimensional manifold, m0, g0. Okay, so that's the main theorem for today. So let me give you some examples of Riemannian managed foods do satisfy this condition. So examples of manifold which do have limiting Carlemann weights. Okay, so first, all two-dimensional manifolds have lots of limiting Carlemann weights. I mean, the idea is at least locally. So in two dimensions, every manifold is locally conformal to Euclidean space. So it actually locally they look like this, where G naught is just equal to 1. And obviously there's lots of Euclidean directions there. So in dimension 3 and higher, you will have all of the constant curvature spaces. So regions in R, N, S, N minus some point, and the hyperbolic space. So these all have limiting Carlemann weights, at least locally. And the reason is that all of these are conformal to regions in Euclidean space. So for Rn it's obvious. For the sphere minus a point, you know that the stereographic projection is a conformal equivalence of this set and Rn. So this is conformally just Rn. And if you look at the Poincaré ball model for the hyperbolic space, it's just a ball where the metric is conformal to the Euclidean metric. So obviously all of these are just Rn up to some arbitrary conformal factor. So more generally, conformally flat manifolds. Admit limiting Carlemann weights at least locally. So these are all conformally flat, but there's others, like some symmetric spaces are conformally flat. Okay, so let me give you even more examples. So if your manifold is a domain in Rn, so any G of this form. So let me call this thing star. Okay. So your metric can, it's just a matrix, so your metric can have an arbitrary conformal factor, and then anything which has this form in some system of local coordinates will be okay. And actually it turns out that you can even have warp products, so you can have a factor of x1 here, I think. Because it turns out that when you have a warp product like this, then you can reparametrize x1 in such a way that so you can have a y1, which is a function of x1. And then in the y coordinates, then this factor here goes away. So even that is okay. And let me also state that this class is obviously stable under perturbations of G naught, because G naught could be anything at this point. But not under perturbations in the Euclidean part, because if you destroy the Euclidean structure of x1, then you will not have a limiting Carlemann weight. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Yeah. The problem. Yeah. So he was. The problem is that your boundary measurements do not carry over. Some of your boundary measurements are in the original manifold, and it's. Guess what we are measuring in the. In the product manifold is not exactly the same. Right. Yeah. No. No.
They can save all energy for the day.
Yeah, something like that.
You have this data for all energies, not only for energy here. You just expand over eigen function along this circle, and you get to giving you basically Laplacian plus U plus K squared as a minus K squared. But so here you would also need to finish the Neumann map on different energy on the solid top and bottom.
Right.
Reduces the theorem with a solid domain. Oh, just with a circle, not a disk. Sorry, I thought with a disk.
Yeah, so I mean, we thought about this, of course. It's a kind of a natural idea, but at least I wasn't able to make it work. Okay. Anyway, so let me finally remark that so here's a number of examples of manifolds which are of this form, and we were actually not able to prove that there exists a manifold which does not satisfy this condition in this original paper. It seems hard to come up with a manifold so that you can prove that there's no conformal scaling and no choice of local coordinates so that you could not make the metric to be of this form. But later, actually, with Liimatainen, we proved that that generic manifolds in... In 3D. Do not have limiting Karlsson weight near any point. So somehow intuitively, what the reason is that what this form of the metric is suggesting, that there has to be some symmetry. There, in particular, what this is implying, that the gradient of the x1 direction will be a conformal Killing vector field on your manifold. So it implies there should be a conformal symmetry in the manifold. And the idea is that if your manifold is of dimension 3 and higher, and if you choose a Riemannian metric at random, then it's not going to have any symmetries. So, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. So this condition implies that there exists a conformal Killing vector field. Yeah. So we actually were able to prove by using some dimension counting and a bare category argument that there's a very large set of manifolds. Basically, almost all of the manifolds will not satisfy this kind of symmetry condition. We still cannot write down a single example of a manifold which does not, but most of them do not satisfy it. Okay, so this kind of gives you a geometric interpretation of the limiting Karlsson condition. And so what I want to do in the rest of this today's lecture is give you an idea of how you prove this. And actually, in order to do that, I have to go a little bit further from this condition, just this Karlsson estimate, because it's not so easy to work with and come up with a simpler condition or somehow an even more explicit condition which somehow characterizes those situations when you would expect that you have estimates of this type. So I'm actually going to do kind of a symbol computation and impose some conditions on the symbol of this conjugated Laplacian in order for this kind of estimate to be true. Yeah. Okay. Right.
But from far away, you know that. Does that tell you anything about the sort of localized
thing? Not that I know of. It's this these are localized very badly. It's yeah. Right. Sine x prime. Sorry, I didn't get it. Sine of x prime. Okay. So is that going to imply that when you have a metric of this type, then there's never going to be any conformal scaling and any choice of local coordinates?
All right, so take a metric like that.
Yeah.
Right, then the only candidate for conformal scaling field is the one you, the dx.
Yeah, dx. Right.
Now, if you alter the diagonal, again, the only scaling field that will work is the dx. That is not norm, but you're not going to have zero in the diagonal field, you're going to have something on zero.
Okay, so maybe we can talk more about this later. Okay, so where should I start? Okay, so really now I want to focus on this condition and try to find some more explicit conditions on the function phi, so that you would expect an estimate of this type to be true. So recall that P phi was the conjugated Laplacian. So it's conjugated by exponential weight, where you have this small parameter in between. And so hopefully the reason why I introduced these scalings here will become apparent now. So I'm going to give you a little lemma, which is a standard in the process of Karlemann estimates. So I want to split this operator in its some of the self-adjoint and skew-adjoint parts with respect to the L2 inner product. So where A and B are formally self-adjoint with respect to the L2 inner product. So, and A will be minus h squared Laplacian of g minus the norm of metric gradient of phi squared, and B will be, this should be, maybe I have to get all all the i's right. So this will be h over I 2 times d phi. So this is a first order operator where you have the inner product of d phi and d u if you apply this to u. And then you have a zero, which is the Laplacian of phi. And okay, so you want me to prove this? So the way you prove this is you just expand this operator out. So you differentiate, so you have this thing here, and then you just use the Leibniz rule to differentiate this and this, and then you isolate the self-adjoint and skew-adjoint parts. Do you want to see this, or? Okay. Yeah. Because I is here. So you have I here, and then you have h over I here. So the I and 1 over I will cancel. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so if you believe me that this is the self-adjoint part and the IB is the skew-adjoint part of the operator, so then I can go forward, give you another lemma. Okay, and this released, what is the basic thing in somehow the basic computation in Kalman estimates? So I want to have a lower bound for the L2 norm P phi u. So this is what we are asking for here. And so now I'm just going to write P phi as A plus IB, and then so I could just as well do the computation. So what is P phi u squared? Again, this is the L2 norm on M. So this is the inner product of P phi u, and you replace P phi by A plus IB u. A plus IB u. And then you group terms. So you have AU, which will give you the norm of AU squared. And then you have IBU, and this is the sesquilinear inner product. So you just get BU squared. And then you have the cross terms. And then you have I, which comes out as a minus here. And so now u is a test function, so it's a smooth, compactly supported function in the interior. So you can integrate by parts, and since these things are formally self-adjoint, then they just come over. A comes here and B comes here, so this thing will be equal to AU squared plus BU squared plus IABU, where this is the commutator of A and B. It's AB minus BA. This simple computation, which again is basic to all L2 Kalman estimates, is showing you that if you can choose a weight function phi in such a way that I times the commutator of A and B, where A and B are the come from this decomposition of the operator P phi. So if this thing is, this commutator is non-negative, then you have a lower bound, or at least some kind of a non-negative lower bound. So you would want to choose phi in such a way that this thing is non-negative. So how do you do this? Let me give you some. What should I? And some of the clearest way of seeing what kind of condition you need to put on phi to have positivity of the commutator is to actually go to the symbols of this differential operator and impose a condition on the symbols. So let me just very briefly explain to you what this what do I mean by the symbol of an operator. So so let's first consider things in Rn. So if Q of xd is a differential operator in Rn, So this is just an order capital N differential operator. So this is I'm using the multi-index notation for differential operator. So what is the symbol of this thing? This is a differential operator in Rn. Let's say you want to evaluate QF of X, and so this will be sum of Q alpha of X, D alpha of F of X, And so what I'm going to do here, I'm going to write f of x in terms of the inverse Fourier transform of its Fourier transform. So f hat is the Fourier transform of f, and this is by the Fourier inversion formula, this is f of x. And now if I just formally differentiate in this integral, so you have, okay, so my dj will be 1 over I dxj. So when I differentiate inside the integral, for every derivative, I will get just the corresponding power of psi. So this will be 2 pi to the minus n integral over r n e to the I x dot psi. And then I will have the sum of q alpha of x psi alpha f hat of psi d psi. So this thing I call the symbol of the differential operator capital Q. So it's just an algebraic quantity, it's a polynomial which describes what this capital Q does. Okay, so on a Riemannian manifold, so if Q is now a differential operator, so Q is essentially, it's either A or B, which I had there. You would like to do the same thing. So what you can do is you can localize. So in some system of local coordinates, your manifold looks like Rn, and then your differential operator looks like this. And then you can write down the symbol in these local coordinates. And then the problem is, of course, if you choose a different set of local coordinates, you will get a different symbol. But the important thing here is that somehow when you go from one set of local coordinates to the other, somehow the top order part of this polynomial will somehow be an invariant function on the cotangent bundle. So it has a principal symbol. This somehow corresponds to the top order part of this polynomial Q, which is an invariantly defined function on T star of n. And now this principal symbol, somehow function will describe what the operator, how the operator behaves, at least somehow, the first approximation. Okay, and then to make things even more complicated, I'm going to use semi-classical symbols. And I guess I should move here because we won't see otherwise. And this semi-classical means that I have this small parameter h in my operators, and I want eventually norm estimates where the dependence on the parameter is very explicit. So it means that I have to take this small parameter into the definition of my symbol. So basically, I'm going to say that in Rn, the symbol psi j, would correspond to h times the derivative in the jth variable. Okay, so this is after this crash course in symbol calculus, I'm going to say that the principal symbols of A and B, so they should be invariantly defined functions on the cotangent bundle of your manifold. And actually, they will have very simple forms. So this will be just psi squared minus norm of gradient phi squared, and B of x psi will be 2 d phi psi. I mean, these are really what you would expect your symbols to be. So they take into account this small parameter h, so that eventually your norm estimates will have the right, or you will have a explicit dependence on h. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, so this, that's due to the semi-classical convention. This is kind of a counterintuitive thing if you haven't seen it before. Somehow, the fact that even though you have a second order operator here, but still because you multiply it by h squared, it somehow decreases the order. So you should consider this and this to be of the same. So they are both part of the principal symbol. So if you don't do this, then you miss the h dependence in your norm estimates. Yeah. So this is I think a matter of preference. This is a matter of preference. The people who I think use do a lot of arguments where you have a small parameter, I think they tend to like the semi-classical convention because it gives you always the right norm estimates. But you can also do it without. Okay, so what is the symbol condition which we get, which would ensure that phi would satisfy, this operator would have nice Karlmanes? So we need some kind of positivity condition for this operator, which is a commutator. So I'm going to give you just a few facts without any further explanation. If you see them, then you know. And if you haven't, then you can read them in some book. So positivity of an operator is somehow related to the positivity of its principal symbol. So a rigorous version of this would be the Gordian inequality. Yeah. Right. Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Okay, so another fact that the principal symbol of the commutator, and this is well known, is going to be in the semi-classical convention, there will be a multiple of h, and then you will get the Poisson bracket of the principal symbols of capital A and capital B. So this is the Poisson bracket. Let me recall what it looks like in local coordinates. Okay. So somehow you're asking for a positivity condition for the Poisson bracket of small a and small b. And let's go further. So in this identity, you also have these two positive terms here. So even though this part could be negative somewhere, you might get positive contributions from here, which would cancel. So again, this is just a heuristic. So because of these two positive terms you have there, so the positivity condition on the symbol would be that you need the Poisson bracket, which is now just a function on the cotangent space, to be non-negative in the set on the cotangent space where both A and B vanish. Somehow the heuristic idea being, if A or B is non-zero, then these are going to give you positivity. Yeah, of course. Okay, so the final fact here which I want to mention is, so recall that eventually we want to solve inverse problems, so we want one solution for phase phi and another solution for phase minus phi to cancel the growth. So somehow this condition needs to be symmetric with the replacement of phi by minus phi. So if you replace phi by minus phi, so then your A, if you look at A here, A will be the same. So A will be preserved. But your B, when you change the sign of phi, then you change the sign of B. So B changes sign. So then this shows that you also need this thing to be non-negative. Okay. So after this long discussions, what I've arrived at is somehow a symbolic condition, or somehow kind of a more algebraic condition for the function phi, which would ensure that you have Karlmann estimates. Okay. The Gording inequality. It's a Swedish guy. G Swedish O R D I N G. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so previously I told you that phi is a limiting Karlmann weight if you expect this Karlmann estimate both of phi and minus phi to hold. But now I'm actually going to give an even more precise definition of limiting Karlmann weight. So if mg, so I'm assuming it's open, so there's no boundary. So a function, real valued function phi, is said to be a limiting Karlmann weight if the following two conditions hold. So the gradient has to be non-vanishing, and you need the symbol condition that the Poisson bracket of the self-adjoint and the skew-adjoint part of your conjugated Laplacian needs to be zero at all those points in cotangent space where both A and B vanish. So this is this definition is due to Koenig-Schersen and Ullmann in the Euclidean space, and then we analyze it further in the Riemannian case. Yeah. Sorry? Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's true. Okay, so let me just, I'm not going to tell you how we get, but I'm going to tell you what actually follows from these conditions. So, if phi is a limiting Karlmann weight, so then you have the Karlmann estimate. Exactly the Karlmann estimate which I wrote down, both for phi and minus phi. So it actually is sufficient, even though it seems that it's a very weak, because you don't have strict positivity, you only have a kind of limiting version of it. But it's still enough, and somehow the way in which you see this somehow degenerate positivity condition is that you get the slightly worse powers of the parameter h in the resulting estimate. So if you have strict positivity here, then you get the Karlmann estimate better powers of h, but then you lose the Karlmann estimate for minus phi. So this is really, it's a delicate thing. Okay, and so it's sufficient. And it's also necessary in the following sense. So if the Poisson bracket has the wrong sign at sum x naught psi naught where a and b vanish. So then the Karlsruhe estimate for phi fails. Actually, it fails in a bad way. So you don't just it's not true that you have a, in this case you would have a Karlsruhe estimate for slightly worse powers of h. It turns out you don't have it for any powers of h. So this argument of David dos Santos, which I guess is not written down yet, but it is kind of necessary and sufficient in this sense. If you assume this non-vanishing of the gradient. So really, the symbolic condition which you got after a lot of heuristics is both sufficient and in some sense also necessary for... Yeah? Sorry? That thing comes up in the proofs. It comes up in many places in the proofs, so I don't have a good explanation of where exactly it is needed. It seems to be needed in several places. Okay. Yeah, okay, so what is known that in, if you have a two-dimensional manifold, then actually you have somehow nice phase functions phi, for, which do have critical points, but for which you still have nice Karlsruhe estimates, and which can be used to solve inner problems. So this is the method of Buchheim, and it's also used by Collin, Guillermo, and Leo Zhu in the Riemannian case. But in three and higher dimensions, I guess it hasn't been found to work. So you don't, or at least I don't know of any useful phase functions which would have nice Karlsruhe estimate where the gradient would vanish. Okay. So how much time do I have? Maybe 20 minutes. So then I want to go a little bit into the proof. So I'm not going to prove this today. Actually, I'm not going to prove this at all. And this thing I'm going to show tomorrow, that if you make slightly stronger assumptions than what you have here, then I'm going to show that you can actually prove Karlsruhe estimates. So I'm not going to do the proof of this, which is somehow is based on this some kind of integration by parts ideas with some convexification procedure for the Karlsruhe weight. I'm going to give you a Fourier analysis proof of the Karlsruhe estimate which we need. Sorry? You'll see tomorrow. Okay. So now I would like to give you some idea of the proof of this theorem. So actually I'm going to use this as the definition of limiting Karlsruhe weight. And so it's kind of a so here, this is a condition on phi, and if you check how it depends on phi, this is kind of a nonlinear PDE for the function phi. So it has to satisfy this nonlinear PDE to be a limiting Karlsruhe weight. But I'm going to show that actually there's a fairly, or not too complicated way of getting this geometric condition, which is exactly the same as stating the existence of some function phi satisfying this. Okay, so let me give you some examples of functions which do satisfy this. So in Rn, so the linear function is going to satisfy this condition. And if n is bigger than or equal to 3, then you have the log of norm of x is going to be a limiting Karlsruhe weight. And both of these are somehow well-known Karlsruhe weights in the theory of unique continuation. But also, as hopefully I'll have time to explain, this is a conformal invariant condition, so it doesn't depend on the conformal class. So actually, in Rn, you can make Kelvin transforms, and then you get new Coron waves out of old ones. So this will also satisfy the conditions. And it turns out in Rn, So this condition is conformally invariant. It's somehow related to the Liouville theorem of classifying all conformal transformations. So in the same way as you know that in Rn, n bigger than or equal to 3, there are basically very few conformal transformations. There's the Kelvin transform, and then there's translations, reflections, and those. In the same way, in Rn with the Euclidean metric n bigger than or equal to 3, you basically only have 6 functions which are limiting Coron. So here's 3, and there's 3 others which I'm not going to write down. Okay. Okay, so this is kind of a not very intuitive analytic condition on phi, and we want to make some more sense out of it. So let me just first compute explicitly what the Poisson bracket of our A and B is. So this is going to be the Poisson bracket of A and B. Is going to involve the covariant Hessian of phi, so it will be d squared phi of psi sharp plus 4, and then there's the Hessian of phi, and then you have the metric gradient. Okay, so it has a simple expression. And the nonlinear PDE would be that this thing is equal to 0, so it's kind of a PDE and a phi. And let me do this computation because it's easy. So these are both invariantly defined things. So psi sharp, this was the musical isomorphism, so I convert the cotangent vector into a tangent vector. So these are both invariant, so it's enough to check this in some system of local coordinates. And the Riemannian normal coordinates is, of course, a good choice. So in normal coordinates, x at some point p, so x of p is 0, you know that the metric has a very special form. So the metric at 0 is the identity. And the first-order derivatives of the metric vanish. And also the Christoffel symbols vanish. So you have a normal coordinates x, and then you have an associated system of local coordinates on the cotangent space, and I'm going to use those local coordinates. So then A is going to be g upper jk psi j psi k minus g upper jk phi x j phi x k, and b is just 2 g upper jk phi x j psi k. So I'm going to make the computation. The Poisson bracket P is equal to sum L going from 1 to N dx I L A dx L B minus dx L A dx I L B, and then you just compute. You use these formulas and use the fact that all of the x derivatives of the metric vanish at your point. So this will be sum L going from 1 to N So we'll have 2G upper JK, something like this. Yeah. And then DXLB will be 2G upper JK phi X JX L Xi K minus DXLA, which will give you 2G upper JK phi X JX L phi X K. And then DXILB will be 2 G upper JK JL phi XJ. Okay. And then this is going to give you the covariant Hessian. And also this is going to give you. So actually you get exactly the thing which I gave you. Okay. So what this is going to tell you is I can rewrite this limiting Carlman condition. So phi is limiting Carlman weight if and only if. So I'm going to take this condition and plug in this computation for the Poisson bracket and see that if A is equal to zero means exactly that the norm of Xi is the same as the norm of gradient phi, and B being equal to zero is exactly that Xi is orthogonal to gradient phi. So, and I can, instead of working on the cotangent space, I can go to the tangent space and I call Xi sharp X. So if and only if D squared phi of XX plus D squared phi of gradient phi is zero whenever X has the same length as gradient phi and X is orthogonal to gradient phi in the Riemannian metric. So it's a slightly simpler way of stating this condition. Okay. Let's see. I'm a little bit running out of time, so let me see what I should do. Okay, so let me then go to one of the fundamental facts. So this is the conformal invariance of the limiting Carlman condition. It's just a simple computation, but it's, yeah. Sorry? Yeah. Something like that, yeah. But I'm going to make a yeah, but I'm actually using conformal invariance, I can simplify this even further, and then it should be evident what's going to happen. Okay, so if phi is limiting Carlman weight in MG, so then phi is limiting Carlman weight in any conformal manifold for any positive function C. Let me quickly show you how this comes about. So you assume that phi is the limiting Carlman weight in MG, so it satisfies basically this condition, and you let G tilde be the conformal metric, so then your A tilde, which is the principal symbol of capital A in the G tilde metric, is given by this thing, but now G tilde upper JK is just C inverse times C g upper jk, so this is actually the c inverse times a. This thing is in the g tilde metric, and this is in the g metric. And the same thing for b. Okay, so so we know the phi's limiting cardinality in mg, and then we want to compute the show that it's limiting cardinality in mg tilde. So okay, I'm still using this earlier definition. Okay, so this will be the Poisson bracket of C inverse A, C inverse B. And somehow the Poisson bracket is kind of a first order differential operator, so it takes first order derivatives of this, first order derivatives of this, and so you can combine things. So you have C minus 2 AB plus C inverse A, C inverse B plus C inverse B, AC inverse. Okay, so this is the expression of the Poisson bracket in terms of the original one. So now if A tilde and B tilde both vanish, so then A and B both vanish, so this goes away and this goes away. And since phi was limiting cardinal weight in Mg, we also know that the original Poisson bracket vanishes. So phi is limiting cardinal weight in M g tilde. Okay. So what this shows is that the limiting cardinal conditions is invariant under conformal scaling. So in particular, if phi is a limiting cardinal weight, I can multiply by my metric by any conformal multiple, if it would make things simpler. And you can simplify things, so call this conformal normalization. So if phi is a limiting cardinal weight in Mg, I'm going to define a conformal multiple which is just the gradient of phi squared. So then phi will be a limiting cardinal weight in the conformal metric g tilde. And the important thing is if you choose this scaling, then it turns out that when you look at the metric gradient of phi in the g tilde metric, will be identically equal to 1. So actually in the conformal metric phi is a distance function. So when analyzing the limiting cardinal weight condition, I can always assume that my phi is a distance function. And then this simplifies. So if phi is a distance function, then the second term in my expression there is going to be, so this is always equal to 1/2 derivative in the direction of the vector field gradient phi squared. I mean, it's just simple computation. This identity is always true. But if gradient phi is constant, so then this is 0. And this term in this definition goes away. So then, we have the following lemma, which concerns limiting cardinal weights, which are distance functions. So the following are equivalent. So phi is limiting cardinal weight the Hessian of phi is identically equal to zero, gradient phi is parallel, and for phi looks like a linear function. So if you follow somehow the geodesic starting at point P in direction V, so then this will be equal to phi of P plus. Yeah, so now assuming that I'm just working with some metric where phi is a distance function. So d phi of p v. Okay. And so under this condition, this part goes away. So actually this condition becomes very easy to analyze. So it's easy to believe that it's going to be the same as the Hessian being equal to zero, and then this. Yeah, these are also simple consequences. So, okay, so what we have learned is if phi is limiting current on weight, we can always make a conformal normalization in such a way so that the Hessian of phi in the new conformal metric will vanish. And so, this is what I wanted to prove, but now it actually follows. Quite easily from this lemma, because the condition is stated in such a way that some conformal multiple of G, so you can always choose. So in the proof, you can choose the right conformal multiple, which is this one, to show that. In particular, I'm going to use this condition 3, where the gradient phi is parallel. Yeah. Okay, so this somehow concludes what I wanted to say about this condition on having limiting current weight. So let me just recap that this limiting current weight condition, which somehow initially was a kind of technical analytic condition, but it is the kind of condition which allows you to at least try to solve the inverse problem in a way which is similar to the Euclidean case. And so this result gives you a geometric interpretation of this condition and gives you a number of examples which do have limiting current on weight. So so when you are looking at phi along a geodesic somehow, so this is just saying that d squared dt squared of phi of xp of tv is equal to d squared of phi so condition 4 is basically this. So if the Hessian vanishes, then the second order derivative of this function depending on t vanishes, so it has to be a linear function with respect to t, which means that it has to be this kind of function with respect to this point. Okay, thanks.